Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day with interesting stories from around the world, and we present them in a way that is easy for you to understand if English is not your first language. Today we have two stories for you. The first one is about older Asian Americans who are doing something unusual when they retire. Then we will hear from a bakery in New York that is honoring Pope Francis's trip to the United States in an interesting way. If you are ready to listen and learn, then let's get started with part one of today's radio program and podcast. Americans with older parents often struggle about how to house those family members. When should elderly parents leave their home? Should they move into a retirement community or stay with their children's family? For Asian Americans, the idea of a retirement home often goes against traditional ways of taking care of elders. So it may be surprising to learn that two companies are spending millions of dollars to create more housing choices for Chinese elders. And there is a high demand for such special housing for the elderly. Jill Robbins has more.
Development manager Brian Polmore tells about the luxury retirement home he is building near Seattle.
This would be the main dining area and dining facility, and directly behind us is where the Zen garden will be.
Aegis Living is a company that builds housing for the elderly. The company hopes to attract Chinese Americans and Chinese immigrants to buy space in this $50 million retirement community.
And then right next to the sports den, we have the Mahjong room, gaming room.
There will be 100 housing units in the building. Some other features include multilingual nurses, chair Tai Chi, a tea room, Asian food, and a Chinese multicultural center. Aegis Living founder and CEO Dwayne Clark says demographic research found that many people want senior care that fits well with their culture.
There's 92,000 Chinese Americans within 25 miles. There's 30,000 within 7 miles. I said, "You're kidding," you know. So I couldn't believe that.
The builders began thinking of how to honor cultural traditions from the early stages. Clark said his company brought in a feng shui expert to review the site plans. The development has been named Aegis Gardens. Residents will pay $15,000 to $60,000 to move in. Monthly rents for its luxury apartments will be as high as $8,000. Across Lake Washington in southeast Seattle, construction is also underway. A nonprofit called Kin'an is spending about $7 million to expand its nursing home into a campus. When completed, it will provide various housing options for elderly Asian immigrants. Most qualify for government financial assistance. Sam Wan has been Kin'an's director for 30 years. In the halls, one can hear conversations in Cantonese and Mandarin. But Wan remembers at the beginning, people did not believe that Chinese families would put their elders in a nursing home.
The new immigrants would be considering having their elders stay at their home, and they live together, three generations together. The nursing home phenomena is pretty much a Western type of culture.
Pam Tsai and her sister thought that way. The women looked after their elderly mother. But when mom, who doesn't speak English, needed skilled nursing care, they turned to Keen An.
My ma, she like a Chinese food, and she talk, you know, Cantonese, like here.
Because Keen An meets those needs, the family finds it acceptable. Across town, Aegis Living leader Mr. Clark remembers similar conversations.
And I remember meeting with this one woman who was an executive, a high-tech executive, and she said, you know, Duane, I spent almost $200,000 going to Stanford and getting my undergraduate degree and my MBA. I don't know that I want to stay home and take care of my mother-in-law. I want to put my MBA to work. And she said, I think this is an idea whose time has come.
He says that Aegis Living wants to make living in their retirement home better for seniors than staying at home.
And if you're the best, then the guilt of people having their mom and dad in this place, will dissipate. It will go away.
Many other assisted living or retirement homes try to match the culture of Asian seniors in the city. Seattle Cairo opened in 1976 for Japanese elders, and the Pan-Asian Legacy House has operated since 1998. I'm Jill Robbins.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. A bakery in New York City is preparing for the visit of Pope Francis by putting the face of the leader of the Roman Catholic Church on cookies. A lot of people are buying them, but are they eating them? Christopher Jones Cruz reports.
Artuso Pastry is in Belmont, a section of the Bronx, one of the boroughs of New York City. It is a small, family-owned business. The bakery makes a lot of different desserts, including the black and white cookie, which has chocolate and vanilla icing. Workers at the bakery have been making special Pope cookies since 2008, when Pope Benedict visited New York. Workers use a special process to put the face of Pope Francis on the cookie. They use edible paper and edible color ink. Natalia Corridori manages the bakery. She says many people have paid about $3 for the cookie, but she says some Catholics are uneasy eating them.
Some of them want to frame it. Some of them want to freeze it. Some people are afraid to eat it. They think it's a sin to eat it. And some people are the complete opposite, and they think it's a blessing to eat it, and miracles might come from it.
Sergio Hernandez helps make the cookies. He says, as a Catholic, it gives him joy to put the face of Pope Francis on a cookie. He says he is proud to be one of the people making the cookies. Doris Murray supports the Pope. She is also a loyal customer of the bakery. but she does not think people should spend their money on the cookie. Instead, she believes people should give that money to organizations the Pope supports.
This whole cookie situation, or the pictures, or give your money to an organization that he advocates for and believes in.
I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. American Billy Davis has been keeping bees since the 1960s. He has followed the sharp drop in the number of honeybees across the country. 2 years ago, he set up a nonprofit group called the Sustainable Honeybee Program. It is developing stronger bees and teaching beekeepers how to strengthen their bee colonies. Brenda Kiesling volunteers with Sustainable Honeybee Program.
All the trees that you see came from a seed. That seed was produced by a flower that was pollinated by a bee. If we didn't have the bees, we wouldn't have the trees, we wouldn't have the flowers, we wouldn't have all the fruits and vegetables, or one-third of the food that humans need.
Experts say more than one-third of the honeybees are disappearing. Their disappearance could have resulted from a combination of things, like climate change, parasites, and chemicals used in agriculture. Americans are trying different ways to fight the loss of bees. They include using less chemicals and pesticides. More people are planting bushes and flowers that bees prefer. The Sustainable Honeybee Program works with bees. The program operates a farm with more than 50 bee colonies. Alex McClellan is the group's chief operations officer.
The ultimate goal here is to generate bees that are able to take care of themselves better. And we've proved by not using chemicals here for the last 7 or 8 years that it is possible to keep bees and to have them survive without the use of chemical interventions, and that's important.
One tactic to help bee populations stay healthy is hygienic behavior, or the ability to identify and remove diseased bees from the colony. Brenda Kiesling says the beekeepers test for this by using liquid nitrogen.
We freeze 100 cells, we come back in 24 hours, and we test what percentage of those cells the workers have removed and gotten rid of. Queens, which have a hygienic percentage of 95 or 100%, are excellent.
Alex McClellan says the group has breeding programs for producing queen bees and sharing them with local beekeepers. He says these hygienic honeybees will be able to recognize threats to the colony and take corrective action.
We keep records on every single hive, and that compendium of records goes back quite a long time. From that, we can look at the genetics and the survivability of all our hives. Prior to this year, I think we had survivability of something over 90%, and that's far higher than the average nationally.
Training volunteers is only the first step. The next steps are up to them when they go home to use what they learned and share with their neighbors. I'm Marcia James.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. John Quincy Adams was sworn in as President of the United States on March 4, 1825. A big crowd came to the Capitol building for the ceremony. All the leaders of government were there, senators, congressmen, Supreme Court justices, and James Monroe. Monroe's two terms as president were ending. President-elect Adams focused his inaugural address on unity. Adams said, "The Constitution and the representative democracy of the United States had proved a success. The nation was free and strong and stretched across the continent from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific." He noted that during the past 10 years, political party differences had eased. So now, he said, it was time for the people to settle their differences and make a truly national government. Adams closed his speech by recognizing that he was a minority president. No candidate had received a majority of electoral votes. So the House of Representatives had to make the decision. The House chose Adams as the next president. He told the crowd gathered at the Capitol that he needed the help of everyone in the years to come. Presidents-elect used to give their inaugural address before their swearing in. So after his speech, John Quincy Adams took the oath of office that made him the sixth president of the United States. His father was John Adams, the second president. John Quincy's mother, Abigail, made sure he received an excellent education. Historian Harlow Giles Unger wrote a biography of John Quincy Adams. Quincy, incidentally, is how the family pronounced it. The historian tells this story about Abigail Adams and her son in 1775 in Massachusetts during the Revolutionary War.
When her firstborn son, John Quincy, was seven, they heard the cannon fire in the distance. They went up to the top of the hill behind their farmhouse and could look across Boston Harbor and see the Battle of Bunker Hill. And she took her boy by the hand. They went back down to the house, and she started melting down the family pewter with John Quincy helping her and making musket balls for the American Revolutionary troops.
Abigail and John Adams were strong patriots. They were one of the founding families of America. Harlow Giles Unger says Abigail Adams raised John Quincy to serve his country.
She told her son that if you do not grow up to be a great leader of this country, it will be because of your own laziness and obstinacy. She and her husband, John Adams, at that point decided to raise their son to be the President of the United States.
As a boy, John Quincy Adams learned to speak at least four languages and read Greek and Latin. He studied Shakespeare's plays. He traveled in Europe. He worked with his father in American consulates and embassies. He graduated from Harvard and was working as a lawyer by the age of 23.
He was a brilliant, brilliant young boy and man.
For about 25 years, Adams held mostly appointed jobs. He was ambassador to the Netherlands, Germany, Russia, and Britain. He helped lead the negotiations that ended the War of 1812 between Britain and the United States. And he served 8 years as Secretary of State. Adams spent most of his career working in public service. Harlow Giles Unger says he could be impatient, especially with lawmakers.
He despised most of the politicians he met in Congress because he found them to be ignorant and self-serving, with no sense of patriotism and sense of obligation to the nation.
John Quincy Adams did not care for political battles. When he became president, he tried to bring his political opponents and the different parts of the country together in his cabinet. His opponents, however, refused to serve. And although his cabinet included Southerners, he did not really have the support of the South. In his first message to Congress, President Adams described his ideas about the national government. The chief purpose of the government, he said, was to improve the lives of the people it governed. To do this, he offered a national program of building roads and canals. He also proposed a national university and a national scientific center. Adams said Congress should not be limited only to making laws to improve the nation's economic life. He said it should make laws to improve the arts and sciences, too. Many people of the West and South did not believe that the Constitution gave the federal government the power to do all these things. They believed that these powers belonged to the states. Their representatives in Congress rejected Adams' proposals. Harlow Giles Unger says some of the disagreements during Adams' presidency helped start the American Civil War more than 30 years later in 1861.
The country was now splitting. The South, most of the South, had never accepted the Constitution as such. The Constitution did away with state sovereignty, but many Americans never accepted that, and especially in the South.
The political picture in the United States began to change during the administration of John Quincy Adams. His opponents won control of both houses of Congress in the elections of 1826. Adams' opponents called themselves Democrats. They supported Andrew Jackson and wanted him to win the next presidential election. Democrats needed the support of both the West and the South to elect Jackson. So they proposed a bill that appeared to help the West. The bill involved import taxes. A number of Western states wanted duties on industrial goods imported from other countries. The purpose was to protect their own industries. Southern states, however, opposed the import duties. They produced no industrial goods that needed protection. They argued that the Constitution did not give the government in Washington the right to approve such taxes. The Democrats expected Congress to defeat the bill they proposed. They thought the West would be grateful that the Democrats had tried to help them, and the South would be happy that there would be no import taxes. But to the Democrats' surprise, many congressmen from the Northeast joined with lawmakers from the West to support the bill. They did so even though the bill would harm industries in the Northeast. The Northerners wanted to keep the idea of protective trade taxes alive. The bill passed in both the House of Representatives and the Senate. This left President Adams with a difficult decision. Should he sign it into law, or should he veto it? If he signed the bill, it would show he believed that the Constitution allowed protective duties. That decision would create even more opposition to him in the South. If he vetoed it, then he would lose support in the West and Northeast. Adams signed the bill, but he made clear that Congress was fully responsible for it. Democrats in Congress made other attempts to weaken support for Adams. For example, they claimed that he was misusing government money. They tried to show that he and his father before him had become rich from government service. Others accused him of giving government jobs to his supporters. This charge was false. Top administration officials had urged Adams to give government jobs only to men who were loyal to him. But Adams had refused. He felt that as long as someone had done nothing wrong, he should continue in his job. During his 4 years as president, Adams removed 12 people from government jobs. In each case, the person had failed to do his work or had done something criminal. Adams often gave jobs to people who did not support him politically. He believed it was wrong to give a person a job just for political reasons. Many of Adams' supporters could not understand. They had worked hard to get him elected. Their support for him cooled. Historian Harlow Giles Unger says, John Quincy Adams was never able to meet the high expectations many had for him.
His presidency was a complete failure. He was able to accomplish nothing.
The political battle between Adams' Republican Party and Jackson's Democrats remained bitter. Perhaps the worst fighting took place in the press. Each side had its own newspaper for support. The Daily National Journal supported the administration. The United States Telegraph supported Andrew Jackson. At first, the pro-administration newspaper called for national unity and an end to personal attacks. Then things changed. The paper had to defend against charges of political wrongdoing within Adams' party. It needed to turn readers away from these problems. So it printed a pamphlet that had been used against Andrew Jackson during an election campaign. The pamphlet accused Jackson of many bad things. The most damaging part involved the wife of another man. That will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.